Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Plato, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 3.
Dialogue titled The Phaedo, the third in the trilogy about Socrates' last days, describes Socrates' execution itself and the conversation he had with his friends just before he died. These events are portrayed years after they occurred by Phaedo, a friend of Socrates who'd been present at the time. The setting is the same prison where Crito talked with Socrates. The ships return to Athens, and the death sentence is now to be carried out. Crito's there again, together with Phaedo and other friends of his. The group enters the prison just after Socrates' chains have been removed. His wife, Xanthippe, and his young son have arrived earlier, and Socrates now asks Crito to take them home. He wants to discuss with his friends for one last time the significance of what is happening. To the end, Socrates is committed to the examined life. Here he wants to reflect on death as a part of that life. Socrates begins the dialogue with a startling description of the relation between death and philosophy. He tells his friends that it's foolish to think of death as an evil. Philosophy itself is a rehearsal for dying. Why, Socrates asks, should someone devote his life to examining truth and then be afraid of that truth when he encounters it face to face?
People who really apply themselves in the right way to philosophy are directly and of their own accord preparing themselves for dying and death. If this is true, it would, of course, be absurd to be troubled when the thing comes for which they have so long been preparing and looking forward.
Socrates' friends are puzzled by this odd description of philosophy, but they're not too perplexed to find the irony in it. So Simmias, one of the friends, replies,
"Upon my word, Socrates, you have made me laugh, though I was not at all in the mood for it. I am sure that if they heard what you said, most people would heartily agree that it was a very good hit at the philosophers to say that they are half dead already, and that they, the normal people, are quite aware that death would serve the philosophers right."
But Socrates responds that the people who say this are right for the wrong reason. In fact, they don't understand what philosophy is. They don't even know what death is. Certainly they miss the connection between them. Philosophy depends on the use of reason, and reason can be free only when it's not hindered by feelings or emotions, by the interference of the senses. In other words, the mind must be left to follow its own course, something that's unlikely as long as feelings or emotions intrude. Because of this, philosophy emphasizes the importance of separating the body from the soul, and it's that kind of dying that Socrates is urging on his friends. To show what he means here, he reminds them of certain ideals or principles that he's mentioned before. There are obvious differences between feelings and ideas, between the senses and reason. Our senses are attached to our bodies. What we learn from the senses is just as changeable as the bodies themselves. Genuine knowledge, on the other hand, doesn't change. This means that the objects of knowledge, in other words, what we know, must also be constant and fixed. It's in these terms that Socrates begins to question Simmias.
Do we say, Simmias, that there is such a thing as justice?
We do say so, certainly.
And such things as the good and the beautiful?
Of course.
And did you ever see one of them with your eyes, or any other of the body's senses?
Never.
The direction of Socrates' arguments becomes clear. We discover ideals or general principles and definitions through reason. Anything that blocks this process should be avoided. In human experience, the senses and the emotions obstruct reason, so philosophy is a practice for dying. As reason constantly distances itself from the body and its senses. And what is this distancing but a form of dying? Socrates speaks here of dying as a metaphor. His friends, however, focused on the execution, are thinking of death not metaphorically but literally. Socrates is speaking even at the end about the life of philosophy. His friends are concerned about the difference that physical death makes, even to the soul or mind. And so, on his last day, as often before, Socrates finds himself in a philosophical tug-of-war. His friends still have to be convinced that reason and the soul are indeed different from matter and body, that the mind does not have physical properties, and certainly that the mind does not have a beginning or an end. The friends believe that Socrates is speaking here about the physical existence of a soul that might continue to live after death, and they're both skeptical and fearful. They press Socrates with some of the standard objections to the idea of immortality. So, for example, Cebes argues that the soul is only a harmony of parts of the body, a harmony which disintegrates when the body does. Even if the soul is more than a harmony and exists before the body, he adds, this doesn't mean that it would survive death. For if a single soul reappeared in a number of bodies, here Cebes refers to the idea of reincarnation, which was a fairly common belief, the soul itself would sooner or later wear out or disintegrate. So Simmias objects,
a tailor makes and wears out any number of coats, but although he outlives all the others, presumably he perishes before the last one. And this does not mean that a man is inferior to a coat or has a weaker hold on life, but still the soul may die, leaving behind its latest covering or body.
Socrates responds patiently to these objections. His friends need reassurance much more than he does. Cebes openly admits the fears they feel.
Probably even in us adults there is a little boy who has these childish terrors. You should try, Socrates, to persuade that little boy not to be afraid of death as though it were something awful.
And Socrates does indeed attempt to give them courage, appealing to their emotions and to their reason. He cautions them against becoming skeptical of all arguments just because there seem to be many conflicting ones that are plausible.
We must not let it enter our minds that there may be no validity in argument. On the contrary, we should recognize that the faults of defective arguments are in us, and we must brace ourselves and try to heal ourselves.
Does Socrates believe that the soul is immortal? Well, undoubtedly he does. But even in his last hours, he's less concerned with the soul's fate after the body physically dies. He's more concerned with the soul's activity in life. On this point, Socrates is unequivocal. There is a radical difference between mind and body, between reason and matter. This difference is even more important in life than in death, and the proof is close by. Socrates is now in prison, awaiting execution, having rejected the opportunity to escape. How can that be explained, he asks.
Suppose that someone were to tell me that the reason I sit here now is that my body consists of bone and muscle, so that when the bones are raised in their sockets, the muscles slackening and tightening enable me to bend my limbs. And for this cause I sit here now.
Socrates strongly challenges this explanation.
You can be certain that these bones and muscles would have been far away by now if it were not for my belief that it was better and more just to submit to the sentence that my city gives than to take to my heels and run.
The reason Socrates sits in prison is altogether different from the physical cause for sitting there. This is the difference between a decision of the mind and a response of the body.
A philosopher's soul will not first expect to be set free by philosophy and then allow pleasure and pain to reduce it once more to bondage, thus taking upon itself an endless task, like Penelope when she undid her own weaving. No, this soul secures immunity from its desires by following reason and abiding always in her company, and by contemplating the true and divine.
If the mind or soul acts differently from the body, this could only be because they are different. Socrates wants to make certain his friends are persuaded of this truth, even if they don't understand it. In addition to satisfying their reason, the little boy in them has to be comforted. So he finally tells them a story, which, like so many fables, mingles fact and fiction. In this story, Socrates describes how souls are judged after they die. Those who have acted wickedly are punished. Those who have lived good lives are rewarded. Those whose lives have been mixed are both punished and rewarded. As a result, souls are cured of their wickedness. The truth in this myth, Socrates suggests, is that people are responsible for the lives they lead. Whatever circumstances they find themselves in, their power of reason enables them to decide what they will do about those circumstances. This truth applies to life. Whether there's literally also a judgment after death is a separate question. And Socrates' words here tell us something more about his method.
No reasonable man ought to insist that the facts are exactly as I have described them, but that either this or something like it is a true account of our souls. This, I think, is a reasonable contention and a belief worth risking. For the risk is a noble one. We should use such accounts to inspire ourselves with confidence.
After he tells this story, time grows short, and Socrates begins to prepare himself for the executioner. Even then, after all he has said, his friends aren't entirely convinced. Their doubts come out in an odd way. How shall we bury you? Crito asks, and Socrates replies teasingly,
however you want. That is, if you catch me and I don't escape you. I can't persuade Crito that I am this Socrates here, who is talking to you now and marshaling all the arguments. He thinks that I am the one whom he will see presently lying dead. No, you must keep up your spirits and say that it is only my body that you are burying. And you can bury it as you please, in whatever way you think is proper.
Soon afterwards, the jailer brings the cup of hemlock that is to be the means of execution. Socrates drinks the poison and then follows the jailer's instructions to walk up and down till he feels he has to lie down. Crito, Socrates says, we owe a cock to Asclepius. And so he again reminds his friends, with his last words, that his death is actually a form of healing. He asks them to make a sacrifice in his behalf to the god of healing. Phaedo, the narrator of the dialogue, then concludes his account of the scene and of Socrates.
This was the end of our comrade. A man, as we should say, of all then living, the noblest and the wisest and the most just.
It's certain that Plato rearranged his description of Socrates' last days, but Plato's portrait of ethics in action is compelling, apart from this historical issue. It is possible, we learn, to value moral principle more than life itself. This becomes clear in Socrates' life and death. In addition to Plato's description of the philosophical life in action, he also lays out for his readers a number of arguments about certain central questions of ethics. These questions themselves constitute a pattern. What do we need to learn or know in order to make ethical decisions? How can that be learned or taught? What's the relation between knowledge and moral character? What, by contrast, is the source of wrongdoing or evil? And finally, the most fundamental question, why should a man live according to ethical values? The last of these questions recurs in many of Plato's dialogues. It's usually raised by a speaker who's convinced that wrongdoing or crime pays better than pursuing justice or doing good. But the question itself needs to be questioned. It seems to demand an ethical reason for being ethical. It asks, why should I or anyone be moral? But if ethical values themselves are being questioned, it hardly seems possible to give an ethical reason to justify them. Many philosophers since Plato have concluded that there is no basis outside of ethics itself for acting morally. But for Plato, the moral life is closely tied to reason. He believes that reason's the distinguishing feature of human nature. and therefore man can know and do what is good only by applying reason itself. Indeed, by acting in accordance with reason and the good, people fulfill their true nature. It's by doing this that the command of the Delphic Oracle, "Know thyself," will be obeyed. This reason-oriented view of human nature underlies a number of perplexing statements Plato makes about the difference between good and evil.
An evil person can never harm a good person. It is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. One should never repay evil with evil.
This is the end of part 3. Please download part 4 to continue.